This is Casey Ruff, your host of Boundless Body Radio. I'm here with another amazing guest that I would love to introduce now, Dr. Sean Baker. Dr. Baker is a U.S. veteran and an orthopedic surgeon. He is a world record holder in the deadlift and indoor rowing in his respective categories. Dr. Baker is most famous for an appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience in 2017, where he talked about the carnivore diet. Since then, he has written a book called The Carnivore Diet. He has become the CEO of MeatRx, of which I am a coach of as of April of this year. And together with Zach Bitter, has hosted the HBO podcast. Welcome to the show, Sean Baker.
Hey, Casey, my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So great to have you on. I have to note for the listener that this is a very, very brief introduction. I could have done that for the entire hour with all the things that you have done in your life and accomplished. And so we're just really grateful to have you on.
Well, like I said, I appreciate the opportunity to at least hopefully have people open their minds up a little bit and think about some stuff. So thanks for the exposure.
That's great. Well, I have to admit, you definitely opened my mind back in 2017. I distinctly remember where I was driving. I was going to an early morning hockey game and I had Joe Rogan on and you were the guest. And it was the first time I was introduced to the carnivore diet. And I'm listening to you and going, what is this guy talking about? And I think it was a question that he talked a little bit about blood work, and I turned off the episode, and I, to this day, have not listened to the full episode on Joe Rogan.
Hey, that's okay. I don't think I've even listened to the full episode on Joe Rogan. I think Joe's doing a great job, but I mean, I just don't have the patience to sit there for 2, 3, 4 hours to listen to podcasts.
Well, the podcast you were doing with Zach Bitter was pretty long.
Well, it was about an hour. Yeah, we typically hour and 15 typically, but yeah, that's true. We do kind of go a little bit, but I guess when you're doing them and you only have so many hours to the day, and doesn't afford much luxury to listen to 3-hour podcast typically. Yeah, right. For me anyway.
Right, if you're not going to have a life that you love, I'm going to start out by asking you the same question I asked a co-friend of ours, Scott Mislinski. He hosts the Carnivore Cast. And the question is, if I don't eat vegetables, will I die?
Well, eventually, yeah. I mean, everybody dies, right? So
fair point.
But the answer is yes, eventually you will die, but you will not die of any acute vegetable deficiency syndrome or anything like that. We haven't seen that occurring, at least, to any significant degree at all. I mean, vegetables, for those people that enjoy them and tolerate them well, they're fine. I mean, they're better than probably a lot of the processed food out there, quite honestly, but they are clearly not essential for human survival or even human thriving. So that's been my experience, both individually and collectively with, the experience of now, into the thousands and tens of thousands of people, not to discount the millennia of data we have from, historical populations, which clearly demonstrated that, vegetables are, clearly not essential for human health. I mean, you think about, like our food guidelines right now, where we're told to eat, 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day, and they should be all different, these different colors. And, and you think about the probability or the likelihood of being able to do that, even 200 years ago, before refrigeration, before, modern agriculture and transportation. I mean, it would have been impossible. I mean, some of these foods people ask you to eat are they not even growing in the same region. I mean, in many cases, they don't even grow on the same continent. And to think they would be essential for human health is just kind of laughable when you think about the totality of the human existence, which many people argue goes back about 3 million years with the very first humans, such as, Homo habilis. And, as humans sort of evolved, and we have to realize that most of the time that humans have been on Earth, including Homo sapiens, we were afflicted with an ice age. And, the climate was very different. It was much colder. Instead of tropical forests, you had more grasslands and you had a lot less plant diversity. And particularly as people ranged, as we know, Homo erectus kind of left Africa, went into Europe and Asia about 1.5 million years ago during the ice ages. And so they would have, clearly been at a loss to eat a wide variety of fruits and vegetables back then. I mean, the thing they did have access to were large mega herbivores, which were in abundance and actually very easy to harvest. So I don't sit here and say vegetables are poison and they're awful and you shouldn't eat them, but I'm to suggest that they are somehow crucial for human health survival or even optimal health, you know, it's just not backed up by, I would say, common sense, you know, if anything else. I mean, we can sort of say, well, there's scientific literature, but, you know, when you look at the nutrition science as a whole in general, it's very poor. I mean, the science, it's not even a hard science. It's a kind of a soft science. And, you know, the endpoints are impossible to do. And it's not the fault of the researchers. It's just the nature of it. You know, you can't do human experiments like you can do animal experiments and then, you know, take the rats and, you know, kill them and cut them open. You just don't do that with humans. So the short answer is no, vegetables are not required. Mm.
We had Dr. Bill Schindler on, and he seemed to confirm what you're saying, that hunter-gatherers didn't tend to have granola bars and yogurt snacks in between finding animals to kill. And I don't think most people even consider the fact that they can walk into a grocery store 365 days a year and buy an apple and not really consider, like, where did we get this? How was it stored?
Yeah, I think it's important to draw the distinction between fruits and vegetables. I mean, you know, first of all, you know, when you like particularly these leafy green vegetables and cruciferous vegetables, which didn't exist, by the way. Most of the cruciferous vegetables were bred from a mustard, you know, mustard plant, and, you know, a couple thousand years ago. So these things didn't exist. And you think about it, to eat leaves, you know, we have the spinach and kale and, you know, rocket and all this other stuff that we're told is so good for us. But I mean, no one would have eaten that unless they were starving, because there's no really calories, no nutritional value. It tastes very bitter. You know, I think early humans didn't have nutritionists telling you to eat, you know, 5 a day or, you know, 10 servings of grains. They ate what was, one, going to provide them energy and calories and protein and nutrition, and then two, things that they actually enjoyed eating, you know, that tasted good and weren't bitter and you know, sort of off-putting. So I think that, and most vegetables, by the way, that we eat today are all modern human creations. They're hybridized plants that didn't exist that long ago. And so, I mean, I would say fruit was probably, in my view, more of something that humans would have eaten likely. Mm.
Yeah. I have an apple tree nearby where I live, and I see the apples that come off of that tree that just kind of grows wild, and the fruit is much smaller. It's, you know, fairly tasty, but not nearly as sweet as what you can buy at the normal store.
Yeah. I mean, we've sort of selected for, you know, high starch content, some of the, like, you know, potatoes and carrots and things like that. And then sweetness. I mean, those things are just, you know, obviously very different from what humans grew up with, I suppose. Mm.
So how do you define the carnivore diet? What is it?
Yeah, I try not to be particularly dogmatic. When I give lectures, back when I used to be able to travel and give lectures when they allowed humans to do that, I would always say that, you know, a carnivore diet is a diet that really focuses on highly nutritious animal-based foods. I mean, this is the essence of it. It's not some dogmatic religion where, you know, if you eat a blueberry, the police are going to come arrest you and lock you up and point at you. I mean, I think if we focus on animal-based foods and then we either fully eliminate or limit as necessary the plant foods with the goal of health, being in mind, then that to me defines a carnivore diet. So that means that, you know, some people will have different tolerances. Some people are fine having steak with various seasonings on it just because they like it, because it gives it more flavor appeal. Some people will have a small amount of fruit or something like that. To me, that's fine. There are many people, and I think this is also something that's important. There are many people that don't do well at all with anything included. So they have to be very strict with that. And I think that's something that, I think that part of it is some, the part that really, for whatever reason, gets people angry or mad. It's like, how dare you not eat in a way that everyone else eats? How dare you buck the system? And I think that's very unfortunate. I mean, you know, we can be open to the fact that people exclude meat from their diet and call themselves vegans. And sort of no one bats an eye at that. I mean, there's a lot of people that sort of think it's ridiculous, but I mean, it's not the mainstream nutritionists who are saying, oh my gosh, that's the worst thing in the world. They just say, well, you just got to be careful and this and that. But when you talk about eating meat and excluding these plants, it's like, how dare you? How dare you go against the teaching, you know, that we've been sort of indoctrinated with since we were kids, literally. I mean, how many of us can remember our parents saying, hey, eat your friggin' broccoli or your peas or your cold peas because they've been sitting on the table for 45 minutes and now they taste awful. I mean, because your parents are just forcing you to eat these vegetables that you don't necessarily like, you know, because it's quote unquote good for you or it's an acquired taste. But you know, to question that is considered heretical, which I think is, I think it's a little silly, quite honestly.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's part of the reason why I love your approach so much. And I want to talk about that a little bit more later on in the show, but you do have a way of making this really approachable for people, and it's welcoming. It should be something that helps people, not something one more thing we have to argue about. How did you first find the carnivore diet?
Well, I was already low carb, and then I was on a ketogenic diet, and I was just kind of immersing myself in the, I guess, the diet culture, the literature, the books. Obviously we now have social media, for good or bad. There's a lot of sort of controversy about it now with censorship and so on and so forth, but that's a topic for another day. But, you know, going in there, and I just kind of stumbled across a group of people on one of the social media sites. You know, they had several thousand people that were all doing this all meat diet. And, you know, I, just like everyone else that hears about it, I thought, well, that's kind of weird. And I started reading and, listening to people and saying, hey, these people are genuine and they're actually getting better. And I'd already kind of bought into this low carb ketogenic, not necessarily cult, but I understood sort of the science behind it, and there was some benefit. And you know, I'd already questioned mainstream nutrition anyway, knowing how sort of poorly the science has been done. And so I just kind of observed these guys for about a year, and just kind of read and looked at some of the source material and read some of the actual source material, and then just kind of, for my own personal sort of curiosity as an athlete, and I've been obviously a very high level competitive athlete my whole life, I said, well, I wonder if this would improve my my performance in whatever whatever event I was thinking about at the time. And so I said, I'm going to try it. And I just kind of eased myself into it. At first I just did like one carnivore meal, which I think was something like steak and eggs. And I was like, well, that's pretty good. And I did that for, I would do it a day, and then I would do 2-3 days in a row. And I always felt good when I did it. I didn't really have any problems. Kind of eventually worked up to a week, then 10 days, and then 2 weeks. And, I think somewhere in the end of 2016, I think it was, about 4 years ago, I did a month, and I felt wonderful. I mean, I really did. I was like, well, this is something that I haven't felt this good in a long time. When the month was over, I said, well, I'm going to go back to kind of a regular diet, because this is a 30-day experiment. And I mean, literally the day after going back on this regular diet, I just didn't feel as good. I just got aches and pains, and at that time I just turned 50. You have some accumulative damage from all the trauma from all the sports I played my whole life. And I was like, wow, I really prefer feeling really, really good. So I went back on the all meat diet. And, at that time I was just kind of starting on social media, had a little bit of a following, but I managed to convince about 100 people to try it. I mean, late, about 6 months in, and we got 100 people to do it. And they did it for 90 days fairly strictly. And we recorded, their outcomes, and by and large, everyone did really well. I mean, the average person lost around 30 pounds in 90 days. They saw significant improvements in pretty much every single subjective thing there was that we could list, that we could do, because we were doing it for free. So we didn't have a lot of money to spend on it. Some objective things like, waist size, weight, heart rate, things like that. We could measure all seemed to improve. Tracked your bowel movement frequency, and everything. I mean, it was very interesting. And then not long after that, I guess I got the attention of Joe Rogan. Apparently a lot of people, must have tagged him on that. He invited me on. And, at that time I wasn't even really aware of the influence that he had. Cause I didn't, like I said, I was kind of vaguely aware of what he did, but I didn't really pay much attention. And I just kind of went on, relaxed. Joe was a really nice, gracious host, and I still contact, I still talk with him, from time to time, still even today. But, I just kind of did my thing, and, I wasn't there to present a scientific dissertation. It wasn't like I brought a bunch of studies, and truth be told, there's not a lot of studies on a carnivore diet. Fortunately, that's changing, and we're seeing things heading that way. But obviously then that sort of got a lot of attention, and unfortunately brought a lot of negative attention my way, because people that are opposed to eating meat, namely sort of vegan activists, just started attacking and aggressively kind of trying to discredit me. And anyway, so that occurred, and here I am today, 4 years later, still going strong, and tens upon tens of thousands of people, maybe even a few hundred thousand people have now either tried the diet or very much aware of it.
I mean, I just an hour ago, I went downstairs into our home gym and my wife was training her client. She's in her mid-50s and they were talking about the carnivore diet. So people are more aware of it. And I think a lot of it is because of that appearance and your ability to kind of share this with the world. What made you want to be vocal about it and share your experiences?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a physician. I mean, this when I was whatever 16 years of age and decided I wanted to go be a doctor and go to medical school and, you know, did all the work and did, you know, something like 13 years of training and schooling and, you know, sleepless nights and, you know, all the studying and working hard. I mean, my goal was to help people. I mean, I truly had a passion for that. At the same time, I was very passionate about athletics and performance, and I found something that I think could benefit both those things, you know, and honestly, my true interest really, even though I do a lot of sports related stuff and strength training and physique and that type of stuff, my true interest is really health. And I just love seeing people that, you know, are otherwise debilitated for various reasons, whether it's mental health disorders, pain, you know, chronic pain issues, you know, autoimmune diseases, GI diseases, whatever it is, get, you know, better and in some ways, someplace, sometimes just miraculously so. And I see that every single day. And so this is something that I'm very passionate that this should be something that more people are aware of, more people are given it as an option, more people try it. Now, it doesn't necessarily going to mean it's going to work for everybody. But I mean, my gosh, what is the harm in doing something that, you know, helps so many people? And we get this pushback, people that don't even, you know, you know, if you think about the science, there's people out there saying the science is settled. There's no reason to look further. And then you show these, you know, not one or two people, but now tens and 20 and dozens and hundreds and thousands of people, literally. I mean, all of them saying, look, I've gotten significantly better. Some of them and many of them have significant objective evidence, whether it's lab studies or imaging studies showing clear reversal of disease coming off medication, so on and so forth. People that were bedbound that are now walking and dancing and running and playing, and you know, they feel like they're, you know, new again, new whole people again. And for other people out there and say, I dismiss it as just, it's simply dangerous. We shouldn't do it. We shouldn't explore it. We shouldn't test it. To me, that's kind of a tragedy.
Yeah, I agree. What was there anything that surprised you the most as the results started to come in and people were trying it? What was there anything that really surprised you that was improving across the board for most people that you didn't think was very obvious when you got started?
Well, I mean, I, you know, again, a carnivore diet, if you think about what, if you look at it on this substance, I mean, it's a low carb diet, obviously. It is a diet that is devoid of junk food, obviously. It is a high protein diet. You know, so, I mean, the fact that people lose weight, the fact that their metabolic issues tend to get better is not a surprise at all to me. You know, what was, I thought the really interesting things to me were, you know, some of the autoimmune conditions that were getting better. You know, this is something that, you know, you can lose weight on a calorie counting diet, on a low fat diet. You typically don't see the dramatic improvements in autoimmune conditions. You know, some of the things that really shocked me were some people that had actually these genetic diseases. You know, one in particular is something called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, where you have this, you know, genetic connective tissue disorder, and it results in people with extremely elastic skin, elastic joints. They suffer from chronic joint dislocations where their joints just pop out of place almost on a daily basis. And they don't, and you know, they end up developing debilitating arthritis because, you know, they've got this joint that's, you know, on a daily basis being traumatized. And we had several people now that have come forth and said, look, I went on a carnivore diet and my joint stopped dislocating, you know, and my pain went away. I was able to work out. And I mean, these are the things that were just kind of shocking to me, that there would be, you know, bona fide genetic disorders that, you know, improve significantly. And so the guess is, you know, these genetic problems are probably subject to epigenetic modifications in the environment, just like, you know, just like anything else might be. So that to me was probably the most interesting, you know, type of thing.
Yeah, that's a good answer. We typically will ask for some listener questions, and this week we have a lot of them. So we can kind of just rapid fire and just briefly talk about each one of these things. Sure. I'm going to start with the most common ones that I get. The first one is fiber. I get this one all the time, that won't you stop going number two if you don't eat fiber?
No, that's not true at all. Now, what will happen is you will go less frequently, because let's think about it. Fiber is not digestible by humans. You know, you bacteria can ferment some of it in the colon, but largely it passes through us unchanged. And what happens, fiber tends to bind up many of the nutrients. So all those organic fruits and vegetables you're eating, much of the nutrition is bound to the fiber and you can't even access it. And so what happens is you, instead of going to the bathroom two or three times a day having a bowel movement, you may go once a day or once every 2 days or 3 days for some people, depending on how much they eat, particularly early on when the transition period, a lot of people may not have a bowel movement for the first week. And usually they're not in any pain. They're not having any issues. They're just not making waste product. Honestly, most people will report that their bowel function, the ease at which they have bowel movements, the lack of discomfort, even the lack of being aware of digestion. You know, like I said, I like to use this sort of, I guess, I don't know if it's an analogy, but if your lungs hurt every time you take a breath or your knees ache every time you go up and down the stairs, you're going to clearly say, hey, there's something wrong here. You know, this is not the way it's supposed to be. But if our guts hurt, we get bloated, we get discomfort, we get, you know, any of those things, we will attribute that to being normal.
Okay, next question. What about carbohydrates in general? Aren't carbohydrates necessary in certain cells? If I don't eat carbohydrates, how will those, you know, the red blood cells or parts of the kidney or the brain, how will they be able to do what they need to do?
Yeah, so I mean, that's partially correct in that they will utilize glucose. That is true. So, you know, there's certain cells that are 100% dependent upon glucose, the brain to some degree, to a certain level, red blood cells, renal medulla, some of the testicular cells will use glucose, but we make glucose. You know, we have a very robust system for making glucose out of either amino acids, which we get from protein, out of glycerol, which we get from fats, or even from lactate, which occurs when glucose is utilized in glycolysis. And we have this lactate reshuttling through the recycling via the Cori cycle. So we have no difficulty producing the glucose we need to run the red blood cells, the brain, so on and so forth. You know, like I said, I haven't had any significant amount of carbohydrate. And I say that because, you know, there's a little bit in some dairy, there's a little bit in eggs, and I do occasionally have that, but, you know, minimal to none for 4 years now. My brain, you know, seems to work well, although some people may disagree with that. But, you know, I'm able to function extremely, extremely well based on, you know, the self-generated glucose via gluconeogenesis, and then subsequently the glycogenolysis that occurs when we, you know, break down the glycogen that's been stored in our muscles and in our liver. And it's pretty interesting, a number of studies now, Jeff Folick and another one that came out this year, and I forget the author, looking at people on low-carb ketogenic states and seeing that, you know, glycogen is pretty well kept intact, you know, with very minimal depletion, glycogen losses within the muscle or the liver. So while we use glucose, we do not need to ingest it to utilize it.
I think that's so important for people to understand. I think a lot of people think of plants as having all the nutrients that we need. Is that where we find nutrients? Are they available to us? What's the story there?
Yeah, so that's another interesting question. And, you know, I think most people point to vitamin C. There's some others out there, folate, manganese, some of these other ones, calcium. But at the end of the day, you know, so the things we require in our diet, and this is this is not even contested biochemistry. We require amino acids, you know, the essential amino acids. We require fatty acids. We require minerals, and we require vitamins. These are the requirements for a human body. You can get them all from an animal diet. Now, if you want to reach the RDA, and again, the RDA is a suggestion based on population studies looking at populations that are eating largely carbohydrate and grain-based diets. So those standards don't necessarily apply to someone on a carbohydrate deficient or incomplete diet, like a carnivore diet. And, you know, even as recently as 2017, they're starting to recognize that. For example, let's talk about zinc. So zinc is, again, one of these required minerals. We know that if you eat X amount of phytic acid, and phytic acid is found in grains, it's found in beans, it's found in legumes, that if you eat 1,000 milligrams of phytic acid or 1 gram per day, your zinc requirement will double If you eat 2 grams of phytic acid a day, your zinc requirement will now triple. So what we see is that our background baseline diet dramatically impacts our nutrient requirements. You know, for instance, carbohydrates drive magnesium requirements significantly. I think I've seen somewhere that to utilize 1 gram of carbohydrates takes up 28 grams of magnesium. So for every carbohydrate you ingest, you're using 28 times magnesium. Now, we have many, many people that are magnesium deficient. We're seeing that being seen over and over again. So the question is, are we not able to get as much magnesium in the diet anymore? Or is it because we're eating a such a high carb diet that we are dramatically driving up those requirements to the point that we have deficiencies? I mean, these questions, and there's numerous, you know, nutrients we can talk about in that regard. But no, you don't need to eat plants to get them. Even the phytonutrients that people talk about, which one are likely not essential. We see that animals, and this is interesting when we get people talking about some of the animal nutrition, you know, we're used to seeing, you know, things like creatine and carnosine and protein and fats and B vitamins and so on and so forth. But we're seeing that a lot of the animals actually concentrate phytonutrients within their flesh, whether it's their fat or their muscle. And so you can get some of those phytonutrients probably in a more bioavailable form in the animal fat or the animal, you know, tissue itself, which is, you know, another thing that I think is interesting.
We had a question come in from Scott Mislinski, and he asked how bulking on carnivore is going for you.
I've put on 40 pounds in about a month. So how's that sound? I was in a very depleted state, and this is partly intentional, you know, due to some of the things I was experimenting with. So, I mean, it's not, I mean, I've kind of gotten back to, so I'm the heaviest I've been at least in 3 or 4 years right now. And I probably will, within another 2 weeks, I'll probably be the heaviest I've been in a decade. And, you know, I've gained a little bit of body fat, but it's largely muscle. Now I'm eating to the point that I don't want to eat anymore. I mean, I'm eating, you know, when I'm not hungry, and I'm eating and I'm walking around kind of full all the time and a little bit uncomfortable. But that's what you got to do when you want to pack on weight. You know, I mean, this is the way you do it. And, it depends how fast you're trying to put the weight on and that type of stuff. I mean, certainly a lot of people, particularly guys, say, oh, I can't eat enough. I mean, it's uncomfortable. It just is. I mean, that's what you got to do. Even if you're full and stuffed, you say, okay, and then you walk away, and then 2 hours later, you go and eat again.
Get some bites.
You just keep doing it until you gain weight. I mean, this is how I did it, you know, 25 years ago when I first went from 240 to 280 pounds. I just ate and ate and ate and ate constantly. Now, then I was eating everything under the sun. I was eating 10 ice cream sandwiches at a time. Probably gave myself metabolic syndrome doing that. So this time, while I'm eating, you know, it's basically a lot of steak. I'm probably eating, you know, 5,000-6,000 calories a day, 400-500 grams of protein a day, you know, similar amount of fat. And so I'm eating a lot, and it's something that, I'll be kind of glad when I get to where I want to go, and I'll kind of dial that back down to my kind of maintenance of about 3,500 to 4,000, 4,500 calories a day, depending on activity level. But
that's a lot of ribeye.
Yeah. It's clear. I mean, to build muscle, and I mean, that's what we care about is building muscle. It requires protein and caloric, you know, and calories. I mean, this is it. It doesn't require carbohydrates, but you've got to be willing to eat to a point where you're uncomfortable and then keep eating. I mean, if you talk to any, even the guys that are, you know, like even using carbs, these guys that are world's strongest man competitors where they're weighing 350 to 400 pounds, you know, these top level bodybuilders that come on stage at 270 pounds ripped. I mean, you know, outside, I mean, of course, they're using all kinds of drugs and that stuff. And I'm not, you know, I'm not somebody that's interested in that or a fan of that. But at the same time, eating for them is probably the worst part. They talk about training, they bust their ass in the gym, but it's the eating. I mean, it's the constantly eating and always being full. That is probably the hardest part. And many of them just, I mean, you think at first you think, wow, it's cool, I get to eat whatever I want as much as I want. But that novelty or fun wears out, you know, pretty quick after a week or two when you're still stuffed and you're like, oh, I got to eat again. That's the hard part. And that's a work part that most people don't realize. And when they say, I just can't gain weight, I'm just like, well, you're just not trying hard enough. You're just not eating enough.
Mm. Let's go the opposite direction. We had a listener question that asked what types of exercise go best with the carnivore diet for weight loss.
Well, I think, again, I would say I would just challenge the premise of that question. I think weight loss is going to be diet. I mean, I think this is going to be the number one factor that's going to allow you to lose weight. And I think, you know, it's going to be how many calories you eat. And I know that's kind of a little bit heretical in the sort of low carb community, but calories do play a role in losing weight. Now, can you potentially eat more calories on a carnivore diet and lose weight relative to another diet? Sure, you can. And the reasons for that are, protein, thermic effect of protein. There appears to be, although it's very highly contested, that fat versus carbohydrates might have an additional metabolic effect. I mean, David Ludwig and others have demonstrated that in a number of studies. It's very controversial, but there's no doubt that higher protein amounts clearly, you know, allow you to eat more grams of protein, more calories and protein, and you'll be able to eat more and, you know, potentially lose more weight that way. So that does occur. Now, having said that, I think for my money, and I think it's, you know, I think when we lose weight, our goal should be to lose body fat and not muscle. I think strength training, you know, resistance training is my preferred, you know, if I have to prioritize what I'm doing, I'm going to do some sort of strength training first. I want to make sure I, you know, squats, deadlifts, pushups, bench press, overhead press, you know, heavy kettlebell swings, something along those lines, some kind of bodybuilding isolation exercise, if you like that stuff. That has to be first, in my view. You want to preserve that lean muscle mass. You want to continue to send those signals to your body that, hey, we need to partition our calories, our protein into the muscle mass and not utilize muscle as a fuel source as we're losing things. So instead of becoming skinny fat and just a skinnier version of the same body composition, you want to recomposite to where you have, you know, more muscle, less fat. And then after that, you know, I think there's, you know, some degree of cardiovascular exercise that's beneficial. I like HIIT training or sprint interval training because of the time efficiency. You know, I can get a very powerful VO2 max building cardiac respiratory beneficial workout done in 10 minutes of sprinting, you know, maybe every 2 minutes, five reps, you know, 10, 20 second all out sprints versus what it would take me to do, you know, an hour and a half of jogging or whatever. Now, having said that in mind, I also, you know, I go for a walk. I take my dogs for a walk every morning. I get up, I go for about an hour walk, do that, you know, once or twice a day, sometimes three times a day. Some days I'll walk 15 miles. That for me, I don't consider that exercise. I mean, it does have an impact and it does, you know, promote some fat loss, but that's probably tertiary on my list. So the last thing I would do is go jogging. I mean, I think that would be, you know, counterproductive for, again, my goal of maintaining muscle mass while I'm losing weight. And I think the diet that I find successful and employed, and I put this in this little carnivore shred program, is a higher protein approach with, you know, with refeeds, with fat refeeds. I think that's important to maintain hormone production, also to kind of maintain a reasonably high metabolic rate. You know, it's, you know, there's going to be, as there's less of you, as you lose significant amount of weight, your metabolic rate will slow down. I mean, that's normal. You know, I mean, if you go from weighing 300 pounds to 200 pounds, you're going to need less calories. I mean, that's just pure, you know, common sense. It's pure physics there.
That's right. Yeah. No, I spent over 10 years measuring people's metabolic rate, and every time if they did a calorically deficit diet, they might lose a little bit of weight, but it would be balanced weight between muscle mass and fat and a lot of water weight. And then they would reduce their metabolic rate. They would teach themselves to burn less calories. So the only way I could get people to keep that metabolic rate as high as possible and lose pure fat and maintain muscle mass was this way of life. Exactly what you just said, carnivore-ish diet, get your lifting in, be active, maybe choose some high intensity intervals, but don't go out and just burn a lot of calories. That's going to do the exact opposite.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's a protein and giving the protein something to do via muscle stimulation, you know, and then, you know, if you go into a little caloric deficit and making it maintainable. This is the thing, because I work with a number of, you know, different athletes, whether they're, you know, high level, you know, MMA guys, Brazilian jiu-jitsu guys, or people that have to make weight cuts, or people that are doing physique contests. And, you know, many of them have done it, you know, they've done it the typical way, the, you know, starvation, low calorie, low fat, low carb, just protein. They find that the carnivore way of doing it seems to just be so much more pleasant. And I think it's because, you know, you sort of maintain some level of hormone function. And I think getting some amount of fat rather than carbohydrate, because you remember carbohydrates are not essential, but fats are. And when you cut fats out for a long period of time, you know, you see a deficit in a number of, you know, biochemical processes, including, you know, hormone production, whether it's vitamin D or testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, you know, all those types of things take a hit.
Yeah. Next listener question, we're going to kind of roll this into one, and I'm going to rephrase the question. There was a question on processed meat with dextrose. There was also a question about eating nose to tail, which for the listener means that you're eating all parts of the animal, you're eating organs, maybe making bone broth, things like that. So my question to you, is there a hierarchy of quality that matters in any particular way?
In theory, yes. I mean, you know, and I think I like to, and in fact, I do, I've just got on my screen pulled up a nice article by Fred Provenza, who I've interviewed. It's called, Is Grass-Fed Meat and Dairy Better for Human Health and the Environment? And he, you know, this is the problem here. We have a lot of sort of supposition that an animal that's eating a grass-finished diet is going to be better for humans. And I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. And I think it makes, you know, certainly from an environmental standpoint, and I've been a champion of this as much as anyone else, you know, with regard to promoting local food, promoting regenerative agriculture, getting people to try to buy direct from the ranchers. I mean, I try to facilitate as much as I possibly can. At the same time, I'm very reluctant to make the claims that it is significantly better for human health just because the data doesn't exist. And this is something that I hope the data will come out there. But even, you know, Fred Provenza, who's one of probably the foremost researchers in this thing, will admit, yes, we do not have human data of any consequence yet. You know, it's just not there. And, you know, anyway, I'll talk about this. And I'm going to interview another researcher in the coming days, Stefan Van Vliet, who's out of Duke University. I think he's originally from perhaps Denmark or Holland or something. But, you know, this is the big problem with that. And we don't know. And so I know Harvard has gotten a study going. They're probably shortly to publish this, and it's something that I kind of helped them recruit and help sort of with the design of the study to some degree. And I asked them, please ask the question about grass-fed versus grain-finished beef, just so if we can see, is there truly a difference in the cohorts? Because when I've done surveys, and I've done a few of them now, up to 10, 12,000 people doing a carnivore diet, and asked them about things like grass-finished, grain-finished, organ meats, yes or no, the differences are really not there. I mean, you know, when we look at outcomes that matter. Did your diabetes go away? Did you get off medications? You know, did you see improvements in all these various areas? And we don't see, you know, at least a significant difference that I can see. And so that's the hesitation I have. Now, if you ask me and you say, hey, what's better for the environment? I clearly will tell you, hey, if you can afford it, buy from a regenerative rancher, farmer, whatever. Get your produce if you're still eating plants. Go get it done that way. Find somebody that's not using no-till, no pesticide, that type of stuff. It's better for the environment. Is it better for your health? That still remains to be seen. Probably it is, but I can't say with 100% endorsement. The problem is I have lots and lots of people, hundreds if not thousands of people that go to McDonald's and go to Walmart, you know, because that's all they can afford. I mean, literally, that's what they can afford. And they go on these diets where they just eat burger patties, you know, burger patties and bacon. And hey, their friggin' mental health, chronic depression is gone. You know, they've lost, you know, 100 pounds. So we know these things work. Now, is there a difference between the two meats, you know, whether it's regenerative versus not? Perhaps there is. Is it, you know, a 50% difference or is it a 3% difference? That's a question we don't know. And until we know that, I have a hard time trying to tell people, hey, you can only do this diet and expect to get good results if you're going to spend $20 a pound for, you know, a grass-finished steak or something like that. Because that sort of requirement makes this a diet that's unapproachable for the vast majority of people. You know, nobody, you know, honestly, I couldn't afford to do it, you know, if I was going to do that. You know, fortunately, I have a number of relationships with meat companies and I get some of it sent as just kind of help for promotion. So I get a lot of meat, you know, sent to me for free, which is great. I mean, I certainly appreciate it. But, you know, to sit there and say you can only do it this way, I think really excludes and it makes us a diet of those that are you know, kind of elite, so to speak. And I think that's a really harmful, because there's a lot of people out there that, you know, can only afford a small amount of money, and all they're going to do is buy the cheap potato chips and cereal that they can get for, you know, two boxes for $3 or something like that, when they could have instead bought a pound of ground beef and, you know,
and a dozen eggs.
So much more nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. I really agree with you there. Last listener question. What is your Thanksgiving Day spread going to look like? Thought this was a great one.
Because I care so much about the lives of turkeys, I'm not going to eat a turkey. No, I'm kidding. And you know, I'm not trying to be too callous, but, I will probably have a standing rib roast because I like beef better. I think that's a great holiday. That's a great holiday, feast. And then some other, I'll probably make something else. I can't remember. I'll think about it the day or two before, see what people want. See, we got people coming from out of town. Don't tell Gavin Newsom, our governor here in California, he may come shut it down perhaps, but I think we're going to have more than six people or whatever, but you know, I'll be a few, and I'll be cooking for other people, non-carnivore. So we'll make some non-carnivore food, I'm sure. And I still have retain some of those skills. And, you know, I cook for my kids, and I still went out years I was doing a ketogenic diet, I still have recipes and still retain those cooking skills and that type of stuff. But the feature won't be turkey. I'm almost sure it won't be turkey. I don't even like turkey, quite honestly. I mean, it's, you know, the farther I've gotten on a carnivore diet, I mean, poultry has gotten less and less appealing. Not that I think there's anything necessarily wrong with it, but it just doesn't appeal to me. And I just wonder, you know, if I was a caveman, you know, 200,000 years ago, running around with a spear, and you said, "Hey, go kill something," am I going to want to try to kill some birds with that spear? Or am I going to go after a big, slow-moving herbivore that's going to have, you know, 50,000 times more calories? I mean, you know, you remember if anybody's ever seen Rocky, how hard it was for Rocky to corral that little chicken in a pen. Now try to catch a live animal out in the wild with a spear. Good luck getting a lot of calories that way. You know,
those wild turkeys look mean too.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true. But I mean, I just don't think it would have been very, very likely that we were spearing a lot of birds, you know, later we developed, you know, it's just kind of interesting. You look at the technology for hunting, and bow and arrow technology came into effect around 60,000 years ago. And that probably was in response to the loss of all this mega herbivore, you know, food sources as they died off from either over hunting, you know, environmental changes, or, you know, some people will suggest climate events, but whatever it was, humans lost their main food supply. And then we had to overcome that. And that's where we, you know, developed all these plant processing skills and, you know, started to have to change our diet. I mean, fortunately, humans did that. That's why we're here today. But the reason we're human in the first place is because of meat. But we maybe survived as a species because we retained that small capacity to, you know, still figure out how to get some nutrition from plants.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. We have about 10 more minutes. Let's take a quick break, bring you back for a few more questions, and let's call it a day. Now, at one point, it said, and I've heard you talk about this before, that you've played rugby in New Zealand with the All Blacks. Is that correct?
Against All Blacks. That's what I would say. I mean, I was playing in their Premier League, and there were, you know, All Blacks playing on opposing teams that I was able to play against. And so that would be more clear. So I guess on the same field as New Zealand All Blacks.
What was that like?
It was a great time. I mean, it was fun. I mean, I was 23, 24, something like that, you know, still kind of young and stupid and, you know, running around, you know, just kind of carefree, you know, running around, being an athlete, you know, drinking some beer and, you know, having a great time. You know, New Zealand is just a gorgeous country. I got to tell you,
it's amazing.
It's a great people. I worked all these odd jobs in kind of the, you know, in addition to playing rugby, I was a bartender. I was a garbage man. I helped shear sheep, delivered milk. You know, I mean, I can't remember what, dug gas lines. I mean, I did all these fun little things on the side. You know, bartender, I said bartender. Yeah, but I mean, it was just, it was a great experience. I love it. Hopefully I get back there one of these days. It's been it's been 30 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's been almost 29 years ago, 28 years ago I was there.
Wow, that's crazy. You mentioned doing studies, and you're actually doing some. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, to be more to clarify, I'm fundraising to get some studies done or get a study done, a carnivore clinical trial, an intervention study where we're going to actually take, you know, a group of people that have a medical condition or medical conditions and put them on a diet for a period of time, compare them to another group that doesn't get the carnivore intervention and to see what the outcomes are, who does better. That is a goal. We're raising money for that. We have, close to $150,000 raised from crowdfunding. We're going to continue. We might have some more money coming in, hopefully, in January. I was pushing pretty hard, you know, starting in the summer, and we raised that money, and then we've kind of taken a little bit of break on the fundraising till we get through the holidays, and then probably at the first year we'll start fundraising again, and then, get that going, get that study done. We've talked with a number of researchers, you know, 5 or 10 different research organizations that could potentially do this for us. I am not a researcher by training or background, so I'm not going to spend $500,000 trying to learn how to do a study. I mean, I'm going to go to professionals that do this for a living and to say, this is what we want to study. You know, these are the outcomes we're looking at. These are the people we want to include. And then here's some money and go do it. And so it'll be an independent study, you know, and we'll see what the results are. Maybe they'll show that, you know, everybody gets sick and does worse on a carnivore diet. I suspect not. But I mean, at least it'll be there, this actual intervention trial. And I think that opens the way for a number of other studies.
Interesting. Where do you see yourself in the future, 5 years down the road?
I plan on still being, you know, CEO of this company I'm doing, MeterX. Hopefully it'll be much larger than it is right now. We're coming up on our 1 year anniversary. We've got something like almost 5,000 members and hundreds of coaches. And, you know, so we're continuing to grow at a pretty decent rate. Hopefully we're going to scale that up, hopefully 2 or 3 times this year, and then hopefully get to the 10, 50, 100 fold by about 5 years. We'll have made some inroads against this nutritional dogma, and enough people will, you know, I'd like to see, you know, many, many physicians empowered to utilize this as a treatment modality for many other patients. I think we can do it. I think there's enough level of frustration, you know, in the community and even among physicians that are just tired of not seeing people get better, and certainly patients with these conditions that are not getting better. And it's just going from, you know, drug to drug, to treatment, to specialist, only to see minimal to no improvement at a huge, tremendous cost. And so hopefully we can start to, you know, change the dynamic or the paradigm on how we deal with these things, because we are, you know, $3.5 trillion a year on medical care in the United States. It's just unsustainable. And that's direct care. You know, if you look at indirect costs, it's something, some people have estimated 50% of our GDP, which wow. is just, and it's growing and it's growing. So that's just not sustainable. So we have to do something different. And I think this is something that is, you know, a looming huge, huge crisis is going to, it's going to be one of the many things that we've got to take care of. Mm.
You have said in the past, I want to know if you still think this, you have said in the past that the best indication for health tomorrow is how you feel today. Do you still believe that more than any other metric you could be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, in general terms, absolutely. I mean, you know, like I said, if I've got back pain today, odds I'm still going to have back pain tomorrow. And I think it's as simple as that. I mean, I think that, yes, there are things that, you know, you can do that will, you know, benefit you long term. But I mean, you know, if you've got diabetes or depression or something like that, if you don't change, you know, this is a problem. We have a lot of belief that the what we do today is going to make us live to 100 or live to 180 if you're Dave Asprey, or, you know, protect us from dying, or some people just think they're going to live forever. Oh, we're never going to die. And the truth is, you know, everybody dies. Most people die of heart disease, and then they die of cancer, and then they die of, you know, pneumonia or, you know, neurocognitive deficits, you know, dementia, so on and so forth, or suicide or something along those lines. I mean, it happens to almost every single person. I mean, everyone dies, but those are the main causes for most people. And I think that we just do not have the data, despite what people say, that show us that, you know, doing this or eating that is going to protect us from this or that disease long term. You know, I mean, what we can say is having diabetes, particularly untreated or poorly managed, having, you know, obesity, you know, having central body, you know, central visceral adiposity, having chronic inflammation, clearly is going to lead to a worse outcome. I mean, that's I think there's more evidence to say that than if you eat this or that. You know, I mean, what you can do is look in the mirror. And when I say look in the mirror, I use that, I'm kind of talking figuratively and not so much literally, but yeah, you can look in the actual mirror and say, hey, I'm leaner, more muscular than I was 6 months ago. But also you can look at other metrics of, you know, of health. You know, you can take a waist to height measurement. You can, I mean, you can tell when you're depressed, you know, when you've got no zest for life, when you just getting out of bed is a chore. Every day is a chore rather than you wake up, smile, you attack the day and you look forward to the next day. I mean, you know, and then you look forward to going to sleep because you're tired and you've done everything and you sleep well. I mean, those things are, I think, very, very important to utilize as metrics for how your health is and quality of life. I mean, quality of life to me is, I mean, if you're going to live to 100 and spend the last 30, 40 years debilitated, you know, ending up in a diaper and demented and muttering to yourself and drooling all over yourself, is that really something you want? I mean, I'd rather, instead of live to 100, I'd much rather live to 97 or 92 and have a full, robust life and maybe drop dead of a heart attack, you know, skiing or something like that. I mean, this is, I guess, a central difference. And quite honestly, I think the people that feel good, perform good, have good mental outlooks, you know, are not in pain, tend to live longer anyway. I mean, that's, you know, that's just the, I mean, there's actually some data that supports that. But at the end of the day, I mean, quality of life, how you feel, is such an important thing we should look to achieve. I mean, I think, you know, when you look at physicians and, you know, as a physician, I think your goal should be to fix the patient in front of you today and not give them some platitudes about stop eating all that cholesterol, you're going to die of a heart attack in 20 years. Your job should be, hey, if we measured the patient, you know, if physicians were paid based upon, you know, let's get our patients happier, let's get our patients healthier today, you know, let's have them lose weight, we would have a tremendous difference in what our emphasis are. Instead, we just look at biomarkers and say, well, we're going to, because your cholesterol is high, we're going to throw you on a lipid lowering drug or you know, a cholesterol lowering drug, or, you know, we're going to put you on some, you know, metformin or some other sulfonylurea or SGLT2 inhibitors to lower your glucose. And then we get paid some sort of, you know, reward for that. But if we were to say, hey, let's make this patient smile and lose weight, and let's see how fast they can run a mile and how much weight they can deadlift, we would completely change how we do business.
Yeah, I love that. I love that answer. That's a great way to close this thing out. Normally, we would ask a few more questions, but I want to close a little bit differently, and I want to read you something that I think was really amazing. These came from my clients when I asked them, you know, if they had any questions for you. A bunch of them said they didn't have questions, and I think that alone is a compliment to how understandable you've made this for them, that they have it kind of settled down. But two replies that I got back, one said, no questions I can think of, but a huge thank you to him for his content and trailblazing. And then the second said, a giant thank you from our family, having the courage to discuss carnivore openly on Joe Rogan. My family has benefited in innumerable ways from carnivore that started with hearing you speak. So thank you for your work. Our daughter has her mother back. My wife has her life back. How does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, that's why I get out of bed every day. I mean, quite honestly, I hear those stories literally every single day. And I mean, and I appreciate it, and I certainly do. And I mean, you know, I mean, and I will fully not take credit, I mean, for, you know, helping to popularize it. But I mean, there's been a lot of people who came before me, you know, even in recent times. But, you know, through the years, I'm not the one that sort of first started talking about eating meat diets. This goes back well into the 1700s. But I think it was Dr. Robert Sivas she might have been referring to in Florida. So that might be who she's talking about. But I mean, this is my challenge to these people is, if you have been helped by what I've done or others have done, I think it's incumbent upon you to help other people, pay it forward, let people know you've the benefit you've received, so other people again, the more people that do this, you know, this isn't a job for one person. This is a job for a community of thousands and hopefully millions of people to change the way we do this. And this is how things change when enough people make it so, and we can drive the market, because this is, you know, I think a lot of this stuff, we just went through a political, an election for president, and, you know, people are, whatever side you fall on, you know, people are kind of become wary of the entire voting system, you know, and so I think the way you vote is with your pocketbook and your actions. And I think this is a lesson for all of us. So I think hopefully more people will be willing to say, hey, look, this is reasonable. And, you know, take the steps necessary to promote it and support it.
Wow. Well, that's a wonderful way to end this conversation. For me personally, it's really been an amazing thing, and it's been an amazing way for me to connect with my clients, and really appreciate you and your work and the courage that you did have to come out with it. Where can people find you?
Yeah. So MeetRx is the number one place I'd like people to go. Just check it out. I mean, I'm there 7 days a week, 365 days a year, with the exception of maybe I'm traveling. Those are the only days I've missed. Every day, 9 a.m. Pacific time, I have an open free forum Zoom call meeting. We have, you know, 50 to 100 people every day in there. We share stories, ask questions, answer questions. You know, a lot of times we have some kind of guest interview that you can actually access those people to ask questions as well. Like this morning we had Dom D'Agostino and so on.
Cool.
So we have all kinds of great content there at MeetRx. That's where I'd really like people to go, because that supports what we do and help us move this community as a cohesive force. Beyond that, I have social media. I'm on Instagram, Sean Baker 1967, spelled S-H-A-W-N-B-A-K-E-R 1967. I'm on Twitter, S Baker MD. I'm on YouTube. I'm actually just started on Parlay, Baker Sean 67. That seems to give you a little more. I know there's a lot of people that don't like that platform because it's politicized, but I don't do any political stuff. I'm not really a political guy. I'm just here. I just would like to be able to speak openly without being worried about being fact-checked or censored, which I have experienced on some of those other social media platforms, unfortunately. Wow. So kind of gotten frustrated with that. So I'm kind of diversifying and kind of being in different places just in case, you know, we see further, you know, because, of, you know, first they started with political speech, which, you know, how you feel about that? I'm not really into that. Then we started seeing how the coronavirus stuff was sort of monitored and moderated and limited, so that they shut down kind of any dissension. And we're seeing some of that to some degree with the diet stuff. And so I think I'm concerned that this all meat diet or low carb ketogenic diets are going to be continued to be demonized and perhaps, you know, deplatformed to some degree. So I think we have to do what we can to prevent that happening.
Mm. Well, that's very interesting. Well, listen, again, we really appreciate you coming on. We appreciate your generosity with your time today and your willingness to share and make something really approachable that helps a lot of people. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, Casey. Got another one of these to do here in a little bit too. So.
Awesome. Well, take care. Have a great day. And this has been Casey Ruff with another episode of Boundless Body Radio.